Well, the real experts in adapting to a changing ecosystem are predators. They're usually mobile, they often reproduce fast, and a lot of them have a lot of intelligence. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. If we respected predators more, could we learn more? Our number 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. We're not real rational about predators, especially when they cost us money. The role of science in predator management, the subject today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. And by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, here we sit in this great state of Alaska with this humongous amount of public lands and undeveloped lands and ecosystem and extreme situations of climate and all sorts of other factors, temperature. And here we sit and we enjoy it. We go out, we recreate in it. We enjoy its wildlife. But in all the time I've been in Alaska, there have been recurring issues involving predators and the science about predators. And we kind of broached this subject some months ago when we had a guy who had written a book about beetles on, about the different kind of beetles that are attacking evergreens all across the western part of the United States. And it was fascinating. And it was, I learned a lot. And the other panelist on that show was Bruce Wright, who has a lengthy CV, which we'll go into a little bit here, but also just, it was a fascinating conversation. The listeners loved it, and I asked him if he would come back because predators are still in the news. Bruce Wright, senior scientist of the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, joins us by telephone from his office. Bruce, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, the you will remember our last show, I think, because it seemed like whatever we started on, we had to cut it off in order to cover more ground in our discussion, because the subject of predators is so fascinating, and your knowledge, frankly, is very impressive. You know a lot about these creatures. You were. I don't know where to start with all your qualifications, but among other things, you have particular expertise in marine biology, especially sharks, and we got into that quite a bit, and in raptors and bald eagles, and it just goes on. You were Tony Knowles' advisor when he was on the Pew Oceans Commission. Science advisor, and that must have been an interesting assignment.
All right. Yeah, that was very interesting. And you know, he was a really quick study when it came to marine science, and he spoke well for the state. By the time we sat down and had our sessions, he was very good, and he challenged the other commissioners, and they came up with a great report, and Alaska was well represented in that effort. But it was very interesting working with that group, and it was a great opportunity.
Well, once I started looking into this predators thing, we have two burning policy issues right now, and I'll get to those in a moment, but just reflecting back over the history of science and public policy over and over again, we see when it comes to money, that's when suddenly sound science doesn't seem to mean quite so much. And so there are like these attempts there have been down through the years, various attempts to try and bring policy and science together, because the fact of the matter is science has a job to do in terms of getting information, and policy has a job to do in terms of making some tough decisions and balancing some things. And the fact of the matter is that I don't think scientists want to make policy decisions. And I think policy people think that they want to reflect good science, but I'm not sure they always do. And so we come like to everybody trying to get better communication. And that's what that Pew Oceans Commission was. And I think, Bruce, you'd have to say it was a little bit misunderstood. I know Senator Stevens had no respect for it whatsoever, for instance.
Right, right. I think it was a bit misunderstood. And maybe that was because Pew Charitable Trust funded it, and they thought that the conclusions were a little left-leaning. But they had some really great scientists that came and advised the commissioners, and they tried to use data to back up what they were saying. They didn't try; they did. They had good, strong data to back up what they were saying. They talked about things like climate change and ocean acidification and overfishing and contaminants in the environment like mercury and those kinds of things. And there's lots of great data on those things. Mm-hmm. Just like the controversy that's taking place right now; it's unfolding right now that EPA's looking to restrict large power plants from emitting contaminants like mercury, and mercury levels are increasing in our marine food web, and so the policymakers, if they looked at the science, they would say, "Wow, this is our problem. We need to do something about it." But they tend to balance that with other factors besides good science.
Well, and there have to be. And then it gets more and more complicated. Like you said, we actually had two ocean commissions, right? And we had one that was from Pew and the other one that was kind of more of a, I don't know what you call it, but it was, you know, admirals and stuff involved. Not that yours didn't have your share of admirals, too. Don't get me wrong. But still, you know, there was a perception that one was left-leaning. And nowadays, it seems you've got to even kind of consider the source when it comes to science because of the funding of science. And this is nothing really new. I remember years ago, I went to my first Wakefield Symposium, which you've probably been to.
Sure.
And it was fisheries biology. And I went in there, and I thought I was somewhat conversant with biology. And here's all these graphs and a lot of graduate students, one after another, just a parade all day long. It was mind-numbing. And the word that kept coming up was recruitment. And I couldn't figure out why is everybody obsessed with this recruitment thing. And so I finally started asking. I says, I'm embarrassed to say, but what is this recruitment anyway? He says, well, that's when the fish enters the population. I said, well, it's kind of already in the pop. Yeah, but that's when you can catch it. Oh!
That's the only time it counts is when you can catch it and sell it.
Right, exactly. And I realized, well, now think
that,
about
where... That was their focus. Yeah, fisheries biologists oftentimes, you know, especially if they're management biologists, that's what they focus on is the harvest numbers.
Yeah. Well, we've got two that are going to come up that are big, you know, policy issues. And one of them I think is fascinating and really just kind of budding right now. People in science are watching it. People in policy, people that are affected by it are watching it. But the population, the general public at large, does not know too much about the situation with sea otters in Southeast Alaska. And they're going to. And maybe we can get ahead of this one a little bit scientifically and talk more about ecosystems rather than talking about somebody whose wallet's going to be punched really hard and already is being punched really hard.
Right.
And it's going to be difficult. Another one that we might talk about is we had a woman who was a teacher who was diminutive and maybe listening to some kind of Walkman deal and was out running and chased down and killed by wolves. And there's a new report from the Fish and Game Department that, you know, says, well, the things that some were seeking to blame it on can't be, they probably are not factors in this. The wolves seem to have chased this woman down and killed her. And that's in the Chignik Lake area. So that's another one where... things can get so emotional that the science can get lost. And I know people who are actual wolf biologists just live in terror of this sort of incident happening, and now it's happened. So I think we might want to go into that, too. Our guest is Bruce Wright, senior scientist in the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, author of Alaska's Predators, Their Ecology and Conservation, which is just a fabulous guidebook. It's amazing that this is the first book. I mean, it's too big for a field. We can't really take it out into the field. But this is the first, you know, book that just tells us about all our predators. I mean, amazing.
It shouldn't be the first, but you know, it took me almost 10 years to write this thing, and yet it's not that complex. It just lays out systematically. I try to lay out the same kind of information on a suite of predators. I think there's 22 represented in the book. There's lots more predators, and many just as interesting as the ones in the book in our state. But I wanted to represent some terrestrial predators, some marine predators, some aerial predators, and vertebrates and invertebrates. So it's just a broad brush at some of the predators and some of the ones that I've worked with and know a little bit about. And I say a little bit because during the 10 years that I worked on writing the book, I found that in every case there was experts that knew way more than I did about each one of these predators. Even though I've tried to specialize in understanding predators, I'm a generalist for predators. And so there's experts that I called on to help me write the book on the specific species. So it was a lot more work than I expected, and I guess that's why this is the first book out there on a suite of more than one predator.
Well, I'll bet you talk to trappers. Talk about people that are experts.
Yeah, I did. I talked to a lot of guys, scientists, just all kinds of people that have information about all these different animals, and then I've had the opportunity to go out and do a fair amount of research on a number of these species myself, and so that added some additional information and then a different focus. So it strictly wasn't an armchair exercise. There was also some active research that took place.
Yeah, some pretty nice pictures you put together, too.
Thanks.
Yep.
And most of the photographs were donated from colleagues all over the world. And that was real kind of them to do that, but people were real excited about the project and willing to donate images.
So I want to get your thoughts, Bruce, because you've been somewhat on the policy side as well as to what might could be done to, diffuse some of these clashes that can come between science and policy. It seems that there's a point. There's something called, I've got this book with me by Christine Shearer I've been reading called Kivalina, A Climate Change Story. And it ties in the climate change denial movement with what she calls the product defense industry, kind of pointing out that the model for what's being done on climate now, climate propaganda, I think I would call it, straight ahead, is very similar to what was done by the, say, tobacco industry. to defend their product. So it's a kind of a business, it's kind of a business situation. And now, you know, I think the public then gets conflicting information from conflicting spins and doesn't know where to go to get information that's not biased. And even the National Academy of Sciences can be, as you know, questionable.
Yeah, you have to be careful and consider the source and listen to the source of the information. You know, that term tobacco science is now used by scientists all the time. And when I worked for Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, the science that we were doing on estimating the spill and the effects of the spill was being countered by Exxon-funded scientists. And just by sheer manipulation of the study design that was intentional, they could come up with totally different results. And so as a group, we often referred to that as Exxon tobacco science.
Exxon tobacco science.
Yeah, right. And it's not difficult at all for a trained scientist to manipulate those graphs and tables that you were referring to at the fisheries conference. You can manipulate that data so that it says something differently, or even better, you can manipulate the study design. In the case of Exxon Valdez, 10 or 15 or 20 years after the spill, the government scientists were saying there's still oil out there and still effects from the oil on sea otters and things. And the Exxon-funded scientists were saying, no, there's hardly any oil out there and there are no effects. And they looked, their study design incorporated a larger universe so that the spot that was represented by the oil spill was insignificant, whereas the study design by the government scientists focused on the areas where there was oil, and so it was significant for that area.
So Bruce, we're getting into an information quagmire here. You're not helping me out. Where does somebody go for credibility? I mean, it used to be that the expression data snooping was used to describe this type of study. And it basically was discredited. It didn't get through peer review. I guess that's not happening anymore.
Well, but peer review is happening, and it is very credible. And I was going to say that if you go to peer-reviewed journals, I'm mostly pretty confident with what I read. I think every scientist is skeptical by nature, and that's how we're trained. And so I'll read these things, knowing that in Science Magazine or Nature Magazine, there's just a lot of good research journals out there, peer-review research journals that I trust, but I still am skeptical, and I'll read through these, knowing what I know. And look at their data, look at their study design, look at their conclusions, and try to put it in the big picture of my world of knowledge, and see if it makes sense. And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah,
the work you saw presented by graduate students at that conference, it may not have been peer reviewed, and so it was work that needed to be refined, and maybe they were just presenting that as to get some more discussion going on, or they were so yeah. you really have to be careful, and you spoke about the National Academy, and they have a great review process, and I've worked with them. I've been fortunate enough to work with them a couple of times, and they bend over backwards to get good reviewers involved and very credible people, and they put out some awesome products.
And one thing, it was under the Knowles administration, as I recall, because wolf control was such a contentious issue at the time, the governor decided it'd be a good idea to refer it to the NAS, and the state actually paid NAS to put together a panel and study what was known and not known about predator control. Now, the odd thing about it is, I read this book, and it's actually quite good. And what it really says is, we don't know that much, and unless you do good measurements, you're not likely to know that much.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, what's happened is both sides just basically used this NAS study to, they data snooped it to justify whatever they already wanted to do or didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Again, back to using a data set and manipulating it so that it'll fit your own agenda. And people do that all the time. You just need to study that and make your own decisions. I thought the National Academy of Sciences a book that they published was awesome. I mean, it talked about bears and wolves and their prey, and it was done very well. But it did indicate that we don't know as much as we need to know, which means we need to use the precautionary approach. It's a term that's thrown out there, especially in fisheries management. But we we need to go slow and be careful, especially when you work with predators. If you take out 10% of the predators from a ecosystem, or 30% or 50%, you're going to see some dramatic effects, most likely. And oftentimes there are effects that you don't expect. In a marine system, if you go out and take the top marine predators out, what will likely happen is you'll get a suite of intermediate level predators. If you take out the orcas in a system, the prey base of the orcas is large fish or marine mammals. Their population may increase, and they may exert that intermediate, those intermediate predators, now that they're released from being preyed upon. Their population, if it expands, could exert a heck of a lot more pressure on fisheries, for example.
Yeah, Bruce, I appreciate you getting us back to the marine system and the sea otters that I do want to talk about, but I want to stay on land for a little bit here yet.
Okay.
And talk about what happened when the wolves were reintroduced, because as I understand it, there was an odd effect once the wolves were reintroduced into the Rocky Mountains. You actually had this weird effect on the fish populations, which you wouldn't think have anything to do with it, but
right,
it did.
Right. Who would have thought if you took the wolves out of an ecosystem that your fish population would suffer, right? Because actually a lot of wolves will eat fish. And so, you know, somebody would say, well, take that top predator out and everything will do better. But when the ungulate population increased because the wolves weren't there to control them, and there weren't enough people to control them either, they over-browsed along the streams and rivers, and that was important habitat for fish because it provided shade and nutrients to the system and insects. And when that habitat was degraded because there were too many browsing animals, the fish population suffered. And that's one of those things that you just don't think about. It's just not obvious. And that's what happens when you start messing around with predator populations.
So it's we still have a huge controversy about these reintroduced wolves. It's probably going to keep going on in the Rocky Mountains. But you're telling me that we're also learning things. When we make the observations, we learn things.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's go to Vic. Joins the program from Anchorage. Sorry for holding up so long, Vic, but I wanted to get back on land before we took your call.
Good morning. I'm glad you mentioned the National Research Council report. That was published in 1997 and quite a while ago, and we know a whole lot more now than we did then. I don't think it's a matter of not knowing enough. I think it's more a matter of not applying what we do know. Right here in our backyard on the northern Kenai Peninsula, we've got a process going on heading toward an aerial wolf shooting program. And I don't think there's a single biologist that has looked at the situation down there and disagreed with the fact that on the northern Kenai, habitat is limiting that moose population, and you could kill off every last wolf and bear and probably not produce any more moose. But yet, about a year ago, when the Department of Fish and Game recommended to the board reducing the population objective for moose down there, the board rejected that. I'm not certain they've ever reduced the population objective, but they didn't in this case. And instead, they requested an intensive management program. The department crafted one, which was based on habitat improvement, and the board rejected that and said they wanted a wolf shooting program. And so now, just very recently, the department has released the feasibility assessment and recommended a $700,000 wolf shooting program on the northern Kenai.
Well, Vic, you're a former member of the Board of Game, and you're a moose biologist, right? Among other types of animals that you study, and what is the answer for in terms of I mean, basically what you're describing is a situation where the policymakers are apparently disregarding the science, or at least from your point of view. What can be done to reinforce the scientific point of view? How can that voice be amplified or heeded better, or not get lost in the noise of public, whatever, biased media? I don't know what to call it.
I've been trying to find an answer to that question for the last 25 years and haven't come up with it. I mean, all the attempts to do what you say have failed. You know, there have been letters from hundreds of scientists that have gone to the governors, two different governors, urging them to apply sound science here and reevaluate some of the programs, had no effect. The National Research Council report, in my view, had no effect. The board ignored the most fundamental recommendation that they had, which was to conduct control as an experiment, to be able to measure the effects of reducing predators and determine what happened and why it happened. Board just ignored that.
I'm sure if we had someone from the board or even staff right now, would say, hey, no, actually, we did it in the 40 mile. We got all our measurements, and we know what we're doing now.
Well, that's highly questionable, and right. Debatable.
Yeah.
And as you were saying previously, you've got these different arguments, and part of it is, what I think is sound science is not necessarily what the board thinks is sound science. In fact, we're far apart on that issue.
Vic, I want to thank you for calling in and being so patient on the phone, and we're going to keep looking for that answer.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. It's Talk of Alaska. Our guest by telephone is Bruce Wright, senior scientist at the Aleutian Pribilof Island Association. That was Vic Van Valenberg there. I don't think he'd mind me identifying him, who has, kind of in despair about the way that the decisions are being made at the game board. One of the things that, Bruce, that I know you were actually willing to weigh in on this issue of wolf control, and I guess I'll ask you to do that now.
Wolves certainly have an effect on the ungulates in a system, but that's not the only thing. Boy, if Vic, I think, nailed it, especially for the Kenai, it's a habitat issue, and moose thrive better when there's disturbed habitat. Disturbed in that you take these old growth spruce and if they're replaced with willow and birch and aspen and then they have a food supply and because of fire control there's not as much of that as there used to be, so the population of moose is down. And then Vic's point that you could take all the wolves out of that system, and you probably wouldn't see an improvement in the moose population.
It might be doable to take all the wolves out.
Well, it is doable to remove.
I mean, they probably move back in, but for a while you probably get rid of all of them on the Kenai Peninsula.
Yeah, well, it's not terribly difficult when you put your mind to it to remove all the wolves from a system. You certainly can do that.
Yeah.
And when you start using techniques like aerial shooting, it's pretty easy.
All right. We're talking with Bruce Wright as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, the Muskox Producers Co-op, whose Alaska Native members hand-knit Kiviute items. Information at www.kiviute.com, Q-I-V-I-U-T. Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the voice of science getting drowned out over and over again, especially when it comes to predators today. And I'll tell you also, next week on Talk of Alaska, it's really thundering down on us. It will be our annual holiday greetings edition. We invite people from all across the state. Call direct to the make a list before you start. That's the best thing. And then just call right to the show and give out good wishes to your friends and relatives around the state. It's a very popular feature. It's a lot of fun to listen to, even if you don't get through. And it's just wonderful to hear voices from all over the state of Alaska and be reminded how we're all kind of related. You know, a lot of people have a lot of relatives all over the state, and they certainly have friends and acquaintances all over the state. So it's a lot of fun for all of us, and a show I really look forward to. Our guest today is Bruce Wright, author of Alaska's Predators, Their Ecology and Conservation. And Carl joins us by telephone from Cordova. Welcome to Talk Alaska, Carl.
Yeah, good morning. I just had a question regarding peer review. I imagine that the quality of peer review varies widely across the board, just like research does. But is there a very well-established method by which people who are peer reviewing examine a piece of research, or is it somewhat of a superficial read for typos and call it good, or does someone carefully recheck the mathematics, the statistical analyses in these reports, i.e. the flute music, as a friend of mine would refer to the calculations, et cetera. And I guess the crux of my question is, how good is peer review, and how much should we rely on it? Thank you.
That's a good question for Bruce, and I think he would answer, and I'm going to ask him to answer, but basically it does depend a lot on the publication. Different ones have different standards for peer review, wouldn't you say?
That's right, Steve. However, for the credible journals and for books, it's not superficial. There's the scientific peer review, then there's the editorial staff takes care of the periods missing and proper English and things like that, syntax and those things. But the scientific peer review is very critical, and usually very credible people are involved. If there's a lot of statistics in an article, you'll have a statistician. You'll ask a couple of statisticians to go ahead and review the statistics, which is very, very important for a credible journal.
Have you served as a peer? You probably have done it, right?
Right, I've done it. I'm not sure.
Did you have a veto power? Did you feel like you had veto power if you felt strongly there was something really wrong with this paper? You could keep it from being published until they fixed it?
I felt I had sufficient input to make the changes, to see the changes made that I wanted to see. Uh-huh. If I had a strong position and it was counter to one of the other reviewers or the editor, then I felt that I felt satisfied that they would take it to another level, bring in some more review. So I felt pretty good about it. Not that I'm always right. So and there's always there's often conflict between reviewers. Their perspective is a little bit different.
Oh, well, yeah.
The editor has to then make the call, we know the people that publish in journals know who these editors are, and some are highly respected and some less so, because some are better than others. But it's quite the challenging exercise to be an editor and listen and read these reviews from these high power credible scientists, and then when there's conflict to figure out which way to go on these things.
Yeah. So it's not a joke. It's something
it's
that's
not
got
a joke.
Got a good
no, it,
deal of
it,
teeth.
It's very serious, and you have powerful peer review for reviewing proposals to organizations like National Science Foundation or North Pacific Research Board or EPA when you submit a proposal to them. And then the articles that come out of those efforts go through a very strict peer review. Yes.
Yeah. Sometimes I don't think you would argue with me on this because you've been in the business long enough, Bruce, that paradigms change. And the older, more senior scientists tend to be the ones who whose reputations are staked on paradigms that might be vanishing. And this can often influence the peer review process to the point where new innovative ideas can take a while to gain any kind of acceptance. I Lynn Margulis comes to mind and all her stuff about how much biology was related to how much coevolution was going on and where even the cell was really composed of small organisms that had joined together in symbiosis. You know, she didn't get that by peer review real fast.
Right.
You know, the people who I mean, you can go back further, you know, the whole idea that the continents drift. There was a whole point where nobody could get anything that even hinted at that published. And then there was the question of the ocean ridges, mid-ocean ridges, and there's a different kind of biology down there. They probably had trouble publishing those, too.
Well, how about the first guys that said that the Earth wasn't the center of the universe or the center of the solar system?
Oh, man, they just off with their heads.
Burned at the stake,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
So sure, paradigms do shift. Isn't that what science is all about, is to get people to, you know, collect the data, get people to think about how these systems really work?
Well, now we're getting down to it, because that is one of the big differences. The scientific world lives to be proven wrong.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And to figure out these things and to get out and explore and make these discoveries. And there's so much still to discover. I gave a presentation to some graduate students last week, and they're all PhD and master students, mostly in the field of ecology and marine science. And it was you could hear that they were all thinking that, well, hasn't everything been figured out? What can I do? You turn over a rock on the beach, and there's so much stuff happening there that we don't understand. There's lots more to learn out there.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I try and go to AAAS every year, and this was like about 3 years back. They had a session on microbes. Mm-hmm. And I went in there, and you said turn over a rock. Every single presentation was absolutely mind-blowing,
yeah.
And this is all mostly research that people are doing for the love of it, because there's basically very little money for microbe research.
Right.
and another one is
something we can't touch. They're so small, but they, you know, they have so much control over how we operate and how systems operate and how the energy is moved through and nutrients are moved through a system. They control so much, and now that these clever scientists that do these genetic analyses of these microbes that they can't grow in the lab and they can't even see, but they can collect their genetic material and they can identify that this is a new microbe and it's a, you know, heterotroph or whatever. It's just fascinating research that we're seeing now.
Yeah, and things that live in extreme environments puts a whole other light on looking for life on Mars.
Yeah, right.
Other light. And it's frustrating to me as a journalist as to how to get these ideas out more to the public. I mean, it's just, I always feel like I just can't, what excites me, I can't always find a way to get it into the story.
Well, there's a lot to talk about in science, and that's why it's a fascinating field. It's just never boring. You know, doing this book, just going through the exercise was exciting, and now that's one way for people to learn about science, giving presentations or you going to presentations or actually doing research or reading a science magazine. There's so much going on out there. It's just in the field of science, it's just very exciting. There's more scientists alive now than have ever been alive on the planet. And, you know, they're doing all kinds of very exciting things, and we're learning more and more about the environment.
Go ahead, Bruce.
You know, Steve, before we switch off of wolves, you had mentioned about the lady, the jogger, that was killed by a wolf or two while she was running out by Chignik Lake. Wolves are attracted to that. You know, it's like a cat when you pull a string across the floor, right? Most of them can't help themselves but to chase the string, to go check it out. They're curious, right? They're intelligent animals. And this lady was running through the wilderness where there were these predators not paying attention. And all I could think is that those wolves saw her as let's go check this out. And maybe it's prey, maybe it's not. And I've had a couple of occasions where I've had encounters with wolves, and it was so similar. Once I was running up, I was jogging up like this lady up the end of Montana Creek. Vision this: it's at the end of the road. It's about a 2 mile jog, and it's about a 2 foot wide muddy sandy trail. And I jogged the trail 2 days before. The only tracks on the trail were mine from 2 days before. And I jogged 2 miles up, turned around, and started coming back. And in my tracks were large wolf tracks. And I looked in the woods, and I couldn't see it. It was gone. And running back, or walking back, because I was so interested in this, this wolf had been following me for over a mile, almost a mile and a half, right behind me. And probably doing the same thing that wolf or those wolves in Chignik Lake were doing, is sizing me up, going, you know, am I hungry? This looks like prey. It's acting like prey. It's running from me. It keeps running. And I'm glad I stopped, right?
We're getting to the point. What's the best point to bite here? Let me see. Do you think it's the Achilles tendon? Or,
yeah.
Should I jump to the throat? It's pretty far away, but...
Well, they, you know, an adult wolf could have taken me in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Especially if I'm not prepared. But when I stop, then it's a new game. You know, I'm no longer prey. And that's the way, when I've done bear research, that's the way I act around bears. If you're confronted by a bear, you know, you stand your ground, you open your jacket, you look big, you pick up a stick and chase it off. And
yeah.
and that works for wolves as well. And I was... Here's another story that's not too dissimilar. I was out clamming with my daughter on an isolated beach in Juneau, and it was midnight. There was fresh snow on the ground, January, and low tide, of course. No tracks in the snow. We get out on the beach, dig the first clam, and all of a sudden we are surrounded by wolves. There was probably 8 wolves just within the edge of the light. We had a lantern. If I lifted the lantern up, you'd see them back up, and they were howling and barking and growling and yipping. And then up in the woods around us, probably about 60 to 80 meters away, were other wolves that were howling. And it was my daughter and myself. She was 6 years, 7 years old, and all I had was a shovel and a bucket and a lantern, you know, nothing to protect ourselves. And they could have easily taken us. I think that situation was a little bit different in that the animals that were up in the woods were probably the adults calling the shots, and the youngsters were down, they're curious, checking out these guys on the beach. And they didn't. They let us. We left.
You know? The guys up on the ridge are saying, danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so Will Robinson and I took off, and we just walked slowly up the beach, and they let us walk up the beach to the car, and then we spent the next half an hour listening to them. There was there was 10 sets of tracks in the snow where we had crossed earlier, and I think that was that there's a big pack of wolves in that part of the Juneau area that is like 20 animals or so, and I think it was that pack. But, it was... You know, they could have taken us, but they didn't. And what was going on there? And then why did that wolf not take me when I ran up Montana Creek? It's not usual that they do this. But it is, when we go out in the wilderness, it's our responsibility to act like a human being and professional. And when I was jogging, I should have looked over my shoulder every once in a while to make sure I didn't have a bear or a wolf closing in on me. And that lady should have been paying more attention out on Chignik Lake.
Bruce,
sorry,
I'll
she
bet
lost
you,
her life, but she, you know, I think she was operating in a dangerous situation and not being as aware as she should have been.
Wow. Well, I want to get around to the sea otters now. and in Southeast. I mean, here's an animal that was hunted almost to extinction, trapped almost to extinction, and especially in Southeast and all the way down into California, and then reintroduced really not all that long ago. What was it, like 1960, 70 something?
Yeah, 60s or something like that. And Steve, we talked about this earlier this week when you and I were talking, and I was thinking about that. And I think when the Russians came in and they were over-harvested, they were trapped out, they were caught, and the population was just decimated, I think that was the game changer, because you removed all of those intertidal predators, and they eat a lot, right, in the intertidal zone. And so all that intertidal prey took off. I just can't help but think that whole system just shifted. There was just this big biological regime shift that changed from being dominated by the predation by the otters to all these now abundant populations of sea urchins and sea cucumbers and abalone. And then when the reintroduction took place, there was this huge food web out there of perfect food for sea otters, and of course their population took off again.
And probably
that was,
rebounded.
That was about the same time that the commercial fisheries started on the pinto abalone and sea cucumbers. I was working for Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commercial Fisheries Division then, right when those fisheries were opening up. And getting the reports from the harvest, it was amazing. These guys would go down with the abalone fishermen. Would go down with a suction dredge thing, and they would suck hundreds of these things up in an hour of abalone out of the cracks of the crevices of the rock. They were just covering the rocks, the system was a lot different than when the otters were there.
Right. So now we're in a situation where, as you said, probably the population is expanding really fast and actually accelerating now because the habitat condition is so great for the sea otters now, with all these little critters under there that the dive fishery has been making money off of. So we're already to the point of tens of millions of dollars of impact. And on the one hand, a person could say, well, you know, the dive fisheries came in, and you were there, Bruce, you saw it happen. They came in at a point into a really artificial situation, and they made money off of it, and now maybe they're not going to be making so much money off of it. But right. On the other hand, you know, you also say ideal habitat, more reproduction, so they're it's kind of an unnatural growth in the population, maybe an unnatural expansion, and then they're top predators. What's going to happen with that?
But, you know, the population.
Who's going to eat the sea otters?
Right. I was going to bring that up. I was over in Elfin Cove a couple decades ago, working in the cove for about a week on an education project, and the locals were telling me about the adjacent cove, and I cannot remember the name. That's where the airplane lands. It's just to the west. It's a fjord that goes back 4 or 5 miles or so. And the locals told me there used to be 70 to 100 otters over there. And one day a small pod of orcas came in, probably the transient-type killer whales, the ones that eat marine mammals, but they didn't know, and I don't know for sure. But they came in, and they took all but a half a dozen or 10 animals is all that was left. They worked it for a couple of days, and they took almost all the otters out of there, which, you know, that was a natural, I guess that was a natural thing, you know.
Yeah.
But holy smokes, what a change that probably made to that system for a little while.
Yeah. And probably we also ought to add on the bottom end of it is that what the sea otters tend to do is eat the sea urchins, and the sea urchins, if they're left to their own devices, eat out all the kelp. Now, if you don't have the kelp, then you're losing a whole layer. It'll be a whole lot of different kinds of habitat, right?
Well, yeah, that's why I'm kind of surprised that commercial fishermen that fish fisheries aren't in the argument because
Well, maybe they will be.
Well, I think they should be, because rearing habitat for many of the species of fish that they harvest are those kelp forests. And when you have too many sea urchins there because you've removed the otters, then you can have a situation that's called urchin barrens, where the urchins will harvest, eat all the kelps, and then you just have coralline algae growing on the rocks, and they're barren. You've lost all that rearing habitat for fish, such as rockfish and sometimes salmon and baby halibut, and small crab use that habitat when it's lush kelp beds.
Yeah, man, but, I'm telling you, Bruce, I'm getting hungry as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
BuzzBiz Studios, a full-spectrum media production studio with marketing services. BuzzBiz Studios help Alaskan businesses be seen and be heard in all advertising media. Additional information at BuzzBiz.biz.
And it's another fascinating discussion of predators on Talk of Alaska with Bruce Wright. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, email talk@alaskapublic.org. And we got calls stacked up till hell won't have them here. Let's talk to Herman in Aniak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Herman.
Yeah, good morning. I was going to talk a little about predator control. I served on our advisory committee for 25 years, and We kept telling them that we could control the wolves out here because they're going into villages and eating people's dogs. And
Herman, you know, Herman, let me interrupt you for just a second. I remember, Herman, when you were calling and we would have Tony Knowles on the program, and you would say the exact same thing to him all the way back then.
Well, right now, moose season's closed here for about a dozen villages because the predators now, the brown bears, are coming in and, you know, it's hard to explain what that guy was saying to a family who doesn't have meat. It's hard to explain to the family of that girl who's lost that, you know, that's her fault. You know, it's not, you know, you got to have predator control. If you don't control the predators, they'll eat themselves and us out of house and home, you know, and you have to understand that. And you're talking about fishing, you know. They should do something about them. Bycatch like King Salmon, I think they got 50,000 here that could feed the whole area up here. You know, you gotta, you know, think of us who live out here who see these things, and it hurts when they hear people who talk about anti-predator control. We live out here, we're seeing the results of not having predator control. Thank you.
All right, Herman, thank you for that great call from Aniak. And I don't think anybody wants to be taking food out of people's mouths, Bruce.
No. He raises some good questions. Actually, you know, there's some pretty good recipes out there for wolves when they run out of caribou, that might balance the system out again. He did make a really interesting point that's certainly controversial, and that is if predator populations like wolves are allowed to expand on their own, they, in some cases, they tend to be cyclic, in that the population will expand, and then they'll exert so much pressure on their prey population that the prey population will crash, and then the predator population will crash. And I contend that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's certainly in the short term, it's a bad thing, but on an evolution time scale. I think that's why moose are such amazing animals that they are, and I think that's why wolves are such great predators, is because they had to go through these ups and downs, these bottlenecks, and survive, and the tough ones survived, and the weak ones didn't, in both cases. In the short term, that's painful when your prey population drops off, and the predators soon follow. We're seeing that out on the end of the Alaska Peninsula. Now, the wolf population used to be trapped, and the prey population got really high, caribou. there's a few moose out there, but mostly caribou. And the people for generations enjoyed all these caribou. Well, now people don't trap the wolves, and there's this big food base. There's this big caribou population, so the wolf population has expanded. And now they are reducing the caribou population quite a bit, and there's a lot of wolves out there. So it's going through this cycle, and I imagine if it's allowed to go through its natural cycle, which again I think is not necessarily a bad thing in long term time scales, then the caribou will probably crash, and then the prey population will follow.
Wow.
And the tough ones, genetically speaking, will survive, and that's what makes these populations so resilient and so strong and makes these animals what they are.
Thanks, Bruce. We got one more call I want to get in. Dick from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Dick.
Good morning. Thanks very much for taking my call. I just had a couple comments. I wanted to thank Bruce for commenting on...
Just a minute. We just have a minute, Dick, so just get to the point right away.
Okay. You destroyed or commented on a couple myths. One, that wolves never attack people. You made it very clear that one should be cautious around big predators because they may be dangerous. So that's important to know, and in fact, it's especially important because people have heard for decades that wolves never attack people, and that's recently been proven not to be true. The other point that you made that is really important to understand is that predation can limit prey populations in your comments about the sea otters and so on. Then the other comment I would make about the National Academy of Sciences report is that it was a good report. It took basically an academic perspective, and among other things, it commented that the programs of the Fish and Game
Department... Is there a drawback? We're about to close up, Dick.
They viewed it as a research project, and... In practical terms, that wasn't workable.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. And Bruce Wright, thank you so much.
You bet, Steve.
All right. We'll have to have you back. It's Talk of Alaska. Thanks so much to Dave Waldron and Josh Yadja. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Providence Health and Services Alaska and North Rim Bank. Alaska Pacific University offers accelerated BA and MBA business degrees with personalized attention for your professional goals, online classes, and small class size supported by a highly respected faculty. A degree from APU is your best value in the business community. Start or finish your business degree at Alaska Pacific University. Enroll now for the spring semester. Learn more at business.alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by the Alaska Pacific University Business Department. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.